Good afternoon, everyone. We still don't have a quorum, but we would like to get started. It's a very important day for us as we take public testimony on our what will be our Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. And right now, we are actually, in technical terms, we are testifying to the Delete Everything Amendment to House File 2414. So I would like to just let people know kind of how we plan to do this. My purpose is to try to make it so that members can get the maximum benefit out of the testimony that we will hear. And when you have a very large bill like this, it covers, although it's all Health and Human Services, there are lots of topics within Health and Human Services. It can sometimes be technical. And we really want to hear all your testimony, have it be helpful to us. So what we will do is take testimony in order by articles of the bill. So it's wonderful if you've signed up to testify. You can certainly testify on more than one article if you have things to say about more than one. But we hope that by doing it this way, it'll make the testimony a bit more comprehensible to those of us who are listening to it and trying to, you know, perhaps incorporate some of your suggestions into amendments for our markup that will happen on start to happen on Friday. So with that, we will start with Article 1, which is children and families. So if you are intending to testify to any of the things that are contained in Article 1, we would ask you to come down and are these in order? Or? Okay, so we do have on the agenda, we have a list of people who've signed up to testify. It's great if you're on there. Thank you very much for letting us know. Of course, we always allow people to testify who are not already on the list. But so please come forward if you're interested in testifying on the first article, children and families. And we would ask everyone to limit their testimony to 2 minutes, please. And so, of course, the procedure for this is that you let us know your name, first of all, because we're always taping. And we need to know on the tape your name and if you have an affiliation. And then if you would please, if it isn't super obvious, let us know what you're talking about so that we can perhaps look at the bill or just understand, you know, we know that each person who speaks has something that's extremely important to them, and we just all want to make sure we're tracking with where you're going. So with that, would the first testifier please come forward? Is that Mary Boo? Welcome to the committee. You get to start the day.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. My name is Mary Boo, and I'm the Executive Director of the North American Council on Adoptable Children. And I'm here to talk about HF 1653 and 1870. And I want to start by thanking Representatives Hassan, Cleborn, you, Chair Liebling, Representatives Pearson and Zerwas, and the other House members who've signed on, including Representatives Moran, Knorr, Edelson, Dabney, Kunesh-Podein, Morrison, Acom, Gomez, Sandsted, and Halverston. This fix to North Star Care for Children would right a wrong. As it stands now, children under age 6 who are adopted from foster care or placed with relatives receive half the support they would have received in foster care and half the support they would receive if they're adopted at age 6 or older. This disparity continues throughout their childhood, regardless of the challenges they face or the disabilities they have. This means, due to the long-term consequences of the abuse, neglect, or trauma they've experienced, their new families will have difficult times struggling to meet their basic or extraordinary needs. There's so much in this HHS bill that is wonderful for children and families, and I want to thank you all for that. But I want to encourage you to remember that this critical fix to North Star Care for Children would help some of the state's most vulnerable children, children who've been abused or neglected and taken away from their birth parents. And this would help them heal and thrive in the adoptive and kinship families who've stepped up to care for them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have Claire Sanford? Welcome.
If I don't fall down. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Claire Sanford, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. Thanks for this opportunity to speak mostly to the CCAP provisions in this bill. MCCA greatly appreciates the focus on program integrity in CCAP and supports the integrity measures included in this bill. We feel like they are common sense measures and things that most providers, legitimate providers, are already doing. And if people are making mistakes, they should be able to get some technical assistance to not make those mistakes anymore. But people who are trying to do bad things, we feel like these would help prevent some of those. Misuse of CCAP hurts us all, both in the current children and families not being served, but also because now we're in this pickle like we are right now, where we're pausing to deal with program integrity instead of investing more funds in the program, and that's hurting kids and families in the future. We must not lose sight of the critical role this program plays, particularly for infants and toddlers. We're very pleased to see that this report brings us into compliance with CCAP provisions in 2014 federal law, because we are staring down a line of facing penalties if we don't get our ducks in a row. These changes were already passed by both House and Senate last year, so it's kind of old business. And by coming into compliance, homeless families will get child care assistance sooner, and they'll also be able to get child care assistance during a time when they're stabilizing their lives by securing housing and employment. Families moving counties won't face the loss of CCAP due to the portability pool provision, and families will have more incentive to move out of MFIT more quickly. The 25th percentile, which is what the reimbursement rates are pegged to in this, is a good first step, but as this committee knows, the federal recommendation is that we are at the 75th percentile of the most current market rate survey, and this does not get us there. And this report also only ties the market rate to the 2018 survey, instead of including an automatic update every 3 years when the survey is done. And this means we are in danger of falling out of federal compliance in another couple years, because it is a requirement that we update every 3 years to the most recent market rate survey. So it's a critical piece of federal conformity, and kind of feels like we might get our head above water and then start to sink again without putting that auto update in here. Finally, we're very excited to see state investment in Retain in this bill, and also efforts to better coordinate early learning scholarships and CCAP for the families and providers who use them. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you much for your testimony. And we do have a quorum. The next, now, I don't necessarily have a list here of who wants to testify on Article 1. So if you want to testify on Article 1, just please come forward. And then just give us your name, because we originally didn't organize this and ask you to sign up by article, so we'll have to play it by ear on that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank the committee for including an increase
and
to
please
the
don't forget your name and affiliation.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm Ann Krisnick with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and want to thank the committee for including an increase to the MFIP cash grant. In your bill and in your budget, it will make a significant difference to families as they work to access stable housing, adequate nutrition, have funds to go to work and meet their basic needs. Specifically, want to thank Representative Kunesh-Pradeen for authoring the bill and all of the co-authors, and particularly the recognition of bipartisan support to address the needs of these families as they're working from crisis into stability. So very appreciative of that. I'm also here on behalf of the Kids Can't Wait Coalition to address some of the CCAP provisions. We thank you for including the federal conformity and the family-friendly provisions that Ms. Sanford just referred to, especially those for families experiencing homelessness and those addressing the current challenges that the portability creates for families if they're looking at relocating in order to have better opportunities for themselves and their families. We appreciate the funding to address the number of families on the waiting list and allow a number of parents to go to work or go to school so they can make things better for their families. We support the change for the provider rates to be based on the 2018 market survey instead of the 2011 market survey, but we also want to make clear that we believe that the 25th percentile is never going to be enough to address the child care crisis that we currently face, and we look forward to working with the members of the committee in the future to address that. And finally, we believe that all CCAP dollars should go to CCAP families, and we support efforts to assure that that happens. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Yeah, please come down. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. It's nice to see you. My name is Joanna Woolman, and I'm here on behalf of the Institute for Children, Families, and Communities and Mitchell Hanlon School of Law. And I would like to say thank you and offer my support for HF 1050, which relates to Minnesota's foster care licensing standards. I would like to thank Representative Liebling and Representative Moran for their hard work on this, as well as the other authors of this bill. This is an important bill in terms of bringing our adoption standards and foster care standards more in line. It's also helpful for relative foster care placements. This will help address some of Minnesota's disparity issues and will make it easier for children to remain in safe family homes. Thank you. Thank you for the support of this.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rod Franks. I'm the Health and Human Services Director for Carver County. But I'm particularly honored to be here today representing MACSA as this year's president, also representing AMC and MICA. We would like to thank the members of the committee for inclusion of several investments for children and families. As you have probably all often heard from counties, our staff are often overwhelmed by child welfare caseloads and complex situations. And we as counties, therefore, appreciate the committee's support for eliminating the county child protection funding withholds, which will allow more predictable funding to help stabilize our workforce. We also appreciate the investments in Child Welfare Training Academy, as this will clearly increase access to training, necessary training, and quickly train our staff in evidence-based child well-being practices, of course, to help us deal with these increasingly complex family situations we face every day. And finally, we also very much appreciate the broad changes in the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, including the program integrity measures, as well as increased provider reimbursement rates, and, of course, the elimination of the basic sliding fee wait list. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Other testifiers, welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Bangard. I'm the owner and director of Here We Grow Early Childhood Center in Mankato. Just two quick points I would like to make. The first is that when we talk about closing fraud loopholes, we have missed a loophole that the auditor stated in his report. It talks about the top 100 paid child care centers, and what you fail to do is you fail to close the loophole where a child who attends for 1 hour can be billed for up to 10 hours for that day for any four-star parent aware rated center. So you have kids bouncing between programs where a provider is being paid for sometimes an entire day and that child has attended for 1 hour. Additionally, when we're talking about CCAP being tied to four-star parent aware rated centers, we have a chain center in this state who has 31% of its centers convicted of maltreatment, did not lose their four-star parent aware rating, but the rest of us did. You know, it's super interesting. They have a lobbyist, A, and B, over $100,000 from the owner of that chain center into the coffers of the HRCC. Don't tell me there's not pay-to-play happening in this state. Don't tell me that people don't know that teachers' unions' pensions are tied to the stock options for some of these companies. We are done playing games. This is my small business, and I will take this to the end. And so did Molly, who tried to save a child's life, who died of SIDS and got wailed on by the Department of Human Services. You all know very well sitting at this table where that money's going.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on the children and families article? Okay, not seeing anyone. So we will move then to the next article, which is operations. Very sexy title, operations. So anybody want to come down and testify on the operations article? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone rushing to the table on that one. So, even though there's a lot in there, I will move then to Article 3, Direct Care and Treatment. Anyone who wants to testify on direct care and treatment? Okay. We know we'll find out what's popular. Oh, we got one. Good. Excellent. Welcome.
Thank you, Rod Franks. Representing MACSA. While Article 3 is one of the shorter articles in the bill, counties have some mixed opinions on it. We'd like to thank you for inclusion of administrative review procedures for counties to appeal the county costs that are related to discharge from Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Facility and the CBHH Community Behavioral Health Hospitals. We do appreciate the work that DHS and counties have done to reform procedures related to discharge, and we look forward to additional work on building our continuum of care so that individuals are not forced to spend additional days in inappropriate settings and are instead moved into facilities where they can receive the proper care at a reduced cost. So therefore, we do have some concerns with the 25% shift to counties for the cost of care for individuals provisionally discharged from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. We have concern any time that state funding is removed because it effectively is simply a cost shift to county local property taxpayers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Franks. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on Article 3, Direct Care and Treatment? All right. Not seeing anyone else on that one. How about Article 4, Continuing Care? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Phil Griffin. I am appearing today on behalf of CASIA, the new organization created by the merger of Elam Care and Bethesda. I am speaking to you today in opposition to the property payment rate changes in Article 4, Sections 25 through 33 of the bill starting at 200.9 of the DE. This language makes changes to the property payment rate that will make it impossible for providers to rely on our partnership with the state to modernize our homes and for our residents. The problem, simply stated, is the current law allows a provider to close a facility, saving the state significant Medicaid expenditures. The state calculates the savings to the budget and shares some of that savings with the provider. The provider can use those savings to make improvements to or to build another nursing home. To add this provision to our laws is akin to a bait-and-switch strategy. Current law supports a long-standing goal of reducing the number of nursing home beds and improving the ones that remain. I urge you to keep the current law. Closures have been made, money has been borrowed, and seniors are relying on the legislature to continue funding of these and all future projects. Please reject this proposed change in funding care for our elderly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Griffin. Anyone else who wanted to testify on Article 4? All right, not seeing anyone. How about Article 5, Disability Services? Hello.
Welcome. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Juliana Keene from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Our 2,300 employees and over 8,000 volunteers provide services in every Minnesota county. And I'm sorry I didn't follow directions very well, but I'd like to speak to a couple of different articles, but broadly, with your permission. Starting with Article 1, I just, again, wanted to echo other statements of the increase to MFIP. Thank you for that investment that will really support a lot of families that we work with. Also, in the CCAP provision for child-only, for individuals who are accessing the child-only MFIP grant, that is really helpful to especially kinship care providers, grandparents who are taking care of grandchildren and really struggling with that. So thank you very much. As Sarah Grafstrom from ARM mentioned in Article 2, we oppose the increase in licensing fees for home and community services. It takes us backwards instead of forwards in addressing the workforce crisis. Now to where we're at in Article 5, really appreciate greatly the inclusion of a competitive workforce factor for those accessing home and community-based services. This will help address the 17% wage gap between DSPs and comparable positions. Also in that same section, really appreciate your proactive steps to support the governor's request to study value-based models in disability services to ensure that people with disabilities have the best possible outcomes. The value-based model study is supported broadly by the disability community, including by ARM-MOR and the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And as I mentioned, it's in the governor's proposal. So thank you for including that. Finally, in the rider, wanted to thank you for your investments in the Homeless Youth Act and in Safe Harbor. We really appreciate your work on this and look forward to working with you as the bill moves forward. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and the committee. My name is Maren Halden, and I'm here testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities. MNCCD is a broad-based coalition of advocacy and provider organizations working to change public policy to improve the lives of people with disabilities. And we are very grateful to you, Chair Liebling, and the committee for including many of our policy priorities in this bill. Thank you so much for including measures to improve MA TEFRA enrollment and renewal. This measure will really help families better be able to access this important care. We're also grateful for the proposed reduction in parental fees. This is an important step to ensure that people with disabilities and their families can afford the care that they need. We're also really grateful for the consumer-directed community supports shared services in the bill. This will make sure that people with disabilities can access the services that they need to thrive in home and community settings. Also in Article 5, we are really pleased with the competitive workforce factor that LSS was just testifying about. This investment in the disability waiver rate system is really going to help address the current workforce crisis that we're facing in community-based disability services. And then I'm just going to note two other things that we're really grateful for in the bill, but they're not in Article 5. In Article 19, the establishment of the Advisory Council on Rare Diseases is one of our priorities, and we're grateful for the inclusion of that. Finally, we are very supportive of repealing the sunset on the provider tax in Article 8, and we are really grateful for the continued necessary care that this repeal will support. We know the committee is really committed to improving the lives of people with disabilities, and we hope that we can continue to have discussions with you as the bill progresses around some of our other priorities, including to improve and protect MA by addressing the spend down and PCA rate reform. But thank you so much for your tremendous work and commitment to Minnesotans with disabilities that you've shown in this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco, political director of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We strongly support the DE. Although we will continue to work for certain changes, the bill will improve the lives of healthcare workers and the people we serve. First, the bill includes our most important priority for this session, Article 5, Sections 53 and 54, ratify and fund a contract for self-directed home care workers, which will, among other benefits, raise the minimum wage to $13.25. The House and Governor invest $36 million to help reduce the dangerous and expensive workforce shortage. Please note a significant portion of that $36 million will go to agencies with traditional PCA employees who are not covered by the provisions of the SEIU contract. Moving on to other sections, Article 8, Section 39 extends the provider tax. The end of the provider tax would not be a gentle sunset. It would be a collapsing black hole that would destroy the HHS budget and suck education and transportation into its death spiral. Third, we support the One Care proposals in Article 9 for a platinum-level buy-in product and the new prescription drug program. Fourth, we thank the author for including in Article 10 a range of important steps to reduce the cost of prescription drug, including House File 4, House File 485, the Alex Smith Emergency Insulin Bill, which is named after the son of our member, James Holt, Jr., and Rep. Morrison's transparency bill. We greatly appreciate that Chair Schultz improved the governor's nursing home proposal with language in Article 4 to better target administrative costs and to require greater transparency in outside contracts. We may remain concerned about the reductions that are there, and we will work with governor and legislators to find ways to reduce delay or eliminate those that impact workers. Finally, our members have always been fierce advocates for our patients, residents, and clients. We strongly support the provisions in Article 14 to protect workers against retaliation when they speak out against unsafe conditions in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mike Burke. I'm the Executive Director of Alexandria Opportunity Center in Alexandria, Minnesota. I'm here today to represent Minnesota Organizations for Rehabilitation and Rehabilitation, which is known as MORE. And MORE is an association of over 100 nonprofit day providers who serve people with intellectual and developmental disabilities throughout the state. To start off, I'd really like to thank you for our inclusion in the competitive workforce factor at 4.7%, as some of the others have, and the automatic adjustments. Additionally, moving automatic inflationary adjustments from every 5 years to every 2 years will be very helpful for us. These efforts will help address the current workforce crisis and provide foundation for future stability within the system. This commitment and investment in the disability community cannot be understated. Again, it is very appreciated and important. Next, though, I need to point out a couple of concerns in other parts of the bill that undermine positive efforts related to the competitive workforce factor. Although I could not find it in the legislation, I noted on line 314 of the spreadsheet that there's proposal includes day service framework changes. Two parts of those changes are problematic for day service providers. First, the change includes lowering of the absence and utilization factor for day services to 4.5%, which we believe will result in a 5% rate cut beginning January 1st of 2021. This 5% reduction would occur 1 year after the 4% increase provided by the competitive workforce factor. Next, the changes to the new framework for adult day services that would reduce rates for these services, we believe that reduced rate would result in closing of many, if not all, of those services because of the low rate. Finally, the fee increases, I'm jumping back to Article 2, sorry. Finally, the fee increases in Article 2 set us back in our efforts, and really those resources need to go to staff and also services. Thank you for the opportunity to share today, and thank you very much for including us in the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there someone else who'd like to come up? Oh, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Alicia Munson. I'm the Public Policy Director with the ARC Minnesota. In testifying today, I will speak primarily to Article 5 of the bill and want to share our sincere gratitude for the policy changes and investments made here that will have a significantly positive impact on the lives of Minnesotans with disabilities statewide, as well as their parents, family members, and staff. Most notably, the reduction in parental fees for MA-TEFRA and HCBS waivers, the proposal to streamline enrollment and renewal in MA-TEFRA, shared services in the consumer-directed community supports option, update to the Housing Access Grant statute, and increased wages for direct support professionals and personal care assistants. We cannot express our thanks enough to the lead authors of these original bills and the bipartisan co-authors who offered their support as well, many of whom are members of this committee. Again, thank you. We're also grateful for the repeal of the provider tax sunset in Article 8, as preserving the healthcare access fund is critical in protecting access to healthcare services and supports for people with disabilities. We do hope to continue working with members of the committee and the Department of Human Services on Sections 57 and 58 of Article 5 to ensure that meaningful stakeholder input is incorporated in the waiver reconfiguration process. And finally, we hope to minimize any negative impacts that may result from the reduction in LPN skilled nursing visit rates in the spreadsheet, as home care is an absolutely vital service for individuals with disabilities and complex medical conditions to receive the care they need in their homes and communities. In closing, we are truly grateful to you, Chair Liebling, and to all of the committee members for prioritizing Minnesotans with disabilities in your work this session, as reflected in this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nachbar. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. We advocate on behalf of the more than 100,000 Minnesotans living with the effects of brain injury all across our state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding the Health and Human Services budget bill. I mean, I know that compassion fatigue tends to set in at this point in the process and recognize that there are simply not enough resources to fund all the good ideas being presented to you. However, I do need to express our profound disappointment that this proposal does not include any funding to continue working on the medical assistance spend down or the income standard. As many of you know, this is something we have slowly but successfully been addressing in baby steps over the last few years. In fact, I'd like to thank Representative Loeffler and her leadership this year and many other years on this issue, as well as Representative Zerwas and his leadership when he was in the majority. There's not enough time today for me to dive into the details of the spend down, which is technically known as the excess income standard, or the income standard or asset standards that have left people with disabilities behind and in a continual state of poverty. But I know that nobody in this room thinks it's right for people who are lucky enough, quote unquote, to be certified as disabled to live on $800 a month and expect them to be able to remain healthy and independent in our communities. So I'd just like to leave you with a couple of thoughts as you proceed with the budget setting process and hope you will consider adding some funding, however limited, to allow us to continue moving the needle on this issue. One, we've made small incremental steps each of the past few years, and we really need to keep this progressing. The spend-down standard is still below the poverty level. We're not asking for funding for more programs, new programs, an increase or growth in available services. We're simply asking Minnesota to let people with disabilities earn more income and be able to save more money, without the fear of losing their health care. And third, we know this is expensive, and that's why it's so hard to do when there's such intense competition for resources. But think about it. The reason it costs so much money is because we're currently taking so much money out of people with disabilities' pockets to pay their medical bills before MA will even kick in. So I look forward to continue to work with all of you and still have a hope and a vision that we can actually solve this problem and help those who truly need our help. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Flynn. I'm a legislative team member of the Minnesota Home Care Association, an association of organizations that provide health care services to Minnesotans in their home. Home care encompasses a wide range of critical health needs, social services delivered to Minnesotans with disabilities, older Minnesotans, and others living with health care needs. I am speaking today of Section 55 of Article 5, which proposes to create two separate billing codes for skilled nursing visits. I do want to note that we are in the midst of ongoing discussions with the department about which exact services this change would apply to, but we do have some concerns about the proposal. Minnesota Home Care Association supports the new requirements to create the separate skilled nursing visit codes for RNs and LPNs. However, we believe it's important for you to understand that the recommended LPN rate of 6301 compared to the current rate of 7502 is not sustainable and will result in clients, your constituents, not having access to care in their homes. LPNs currently play a very significant role in providing home care to older adults and Minnesotans with disabilities and helping them remain in their homes versus the institutional setting. This proposed lower rate for the LPN service will make it even more difficult for providers to provide this service and will result in less access to in-home care, ultimately resulting in costly hospital stays and potentially higher risk of rehospitalizations. The bill recommends that the LPN be 84% of the already inadequate RN rate. While we respect the fact that the percentage is based on the RN and LPN rate variances in neighboring states, it is important to note that Minnesota's RN rate is significantly lower than other Midwest states, as you know, 75 as compared to 115, 112, and 85 in neighboring states. We're already facing a workforce crisis under the current rates in being able to hire nurses to work in the critical area of home care. On behalf of Minnesotans who choose to receive care in their home and the organizations that provide those services, we ask that you reconsider this rate cut for LPNs and help us ensure clients have access to high-quality care. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for hearing our concerns.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Other testifiers on the Article 5 Disability Services, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today on this bill. And I want to thank all of you for the hard work that it took to develop this. And I want to especially thank you for several provisions that help people that are deaf.
Please do state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mary. Excuse me, Madam Chair. Mary Hartnett, Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We're a commission that advocates for and with the people that are 20% of Minnesotans who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. I want to thank you for provision. The provisions in Article 5 that include changes to the equipment distribution program. Four years ago, our commission advocated for funding for studies that would modernize the program and provide consumers with the telecommunication devices and the services they need. The feedback from citizens is reflected in this bill. We have high hopes for increasing telecommunication access for the 20% of Minnesotans with hearing loss. Sometimes you have studies before you and you wonder whatever happens to them. That study is directly reflected in this bill. Next, we want to also thank you in Article 12 for extending the life of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. It will make a big difference for babies identified with hearing loss in the state and will ensure that we are using state-of-the-art screening, identification, and interventions. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else who wants to speak on the disability services article in the bill? Okay. Not seeing anybody else. So we will then move on to Article 6, Chemical and Mental Health. So if you'd like to testify on this, please come on down. And of course, it's fine to come back. We have no problem with that. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that. I appreciate the invitation. Rod Franks, representing MACSA. We'd like to thank you for your inclusion of provisions to fund existing children's residential treatment facilities and expand our continuum of care for children in need of these mental health services. As has been said before in front of this committee, the recent end of the federal reimbursement for the services at the state's children's residential treatment centers has prompted a rapid response to fix a system that was truly never adequately built in the first place. So counties are firmly committed to working with the state and other stakeholders to moving our state towards a more sustainable, community-driven continuum of care to properly address the very complex mental health needs of some of our children. And the funding contained in this bill is very critical so that we continue to do that work. Thank you. Now, speaking of broken systems, we also very much appreciate your support for the establishing a community competency restoration task force. As you may recall, recently the state of Minnesota decided to no longer provide competency restoration services. This unfortunately has left counties and other stakeholders quite unprepared to pursue effective restoration practices for individuals in our criminal justice system. So we as counties look forward to being a part of the discussions and the solutions on this very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Come on down, Chemical and Mental Health. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Jenny Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And we want to say thank you so much for the focus given and the support for behavioral health in this budget. A huge, huge thank you for inclusion of certified community behavioral health clinics. Thank you to Representative Bierman for carrying this and to you, Madam Chair, and the members for including this in your budget. We really believe that this is a tangible solution to the many challenges we are facing in our mental health system. And we're grateful for your support on this. Also, thank you for the changes included for behavioral health homes and the funding included for SchoolLink mental health grants, crisis grants, and children's grants, and really all of the funding that is going toward mental health in this article. We do have to mention that we have some concerns that proposals addressing the rate system and the reimbursement of our foundational services here in our mental health system were not included in this budget. We completely recognize that there are complexities and challenges of reconstructing a huge part of how we are paying for these services in our state methodology, and we agree with the long-term goals. We have some concerns, though, about our providers' ability to maintain our existing services, let alone being able to grow those services and also innovate when while these long-term goals are sought and implemented. We are here today asking to be a partner as we develop these solutions, and we believe that we have a proposal moving forward this year that we think has some, that can offer some solutions to this long-term strategy. Lastly, I'm getting a little bit outside of this article, but thank you so much for continuing the provider tax. As safety net providers, coverage for our clients and the programs that we utilize out of the Healthcare Access Fund are critically important to our members. We look forward to working with you, with the committee, with the state and stakeholders on these proposals and others moving forward. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Who else would like to speak on chemical and mental health, the Article 6? Okay. I'm not seeing anyone. So we'll move to a very short, well, it's not that short, but Article 7, Mental Health Uniform Services Standards. Okay. Thank you. Come on down and
thank
welcome
you again, Madam Chair and Committee. I will keep this short on Article 7, but thank you so much for the inclusion of changes to the statute, which currently prevent local social service agencies from fully cooperating with law enforcement, so we really thank you with that. It will make our work much more effective. And as counties move toward a more integrated care for individuals, it's really critical for our work that we look at better ways to address the chemical and mental health needs of individuals prior to their incarceration. So counties very much want to continue to seek more community-based interventions that can not only best serve the individuals that we meet, but get them the right care at the right place, at the right time, and in the right place, so that we can save local and state tax dollars by decreasing recidivism and avoiding costly jail time. Thank you.
All right, and before you go, I'm just not certain if you said your name again, so could you just do that, please?
My apologies, Madam Chair. Rod Franks, representing MAXA.
All right, thank you. And I don't know, you might have said it, but, you know, we just want to make sure because we are taping, so thank you.
Thank you.
And, okay, is there anyone else who wants to speak on Article 7? Okay, Article 8, health care. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tara Erickson. I'm here today representing Dental Access Partners, a collaboration between Appletree Dental, Community Dental Care, and Hennepin County Medical Center. Our three nonprofit entities provided nearly 15% of the Medicaid care in the state last year. We want to thank you, Representative Liebling, for your ongoing support for reforming our Medicaid dental program. We also want to thank you for fully funding House File 840, authored by Representative Lean, which would add periodontal coverage, also known as gum disease, back as a covered benefit in the Medicaid program. Our groups have been struggling to provide this service since the benefit was eliminated in 2009. When a patient under Medicaid program does not have a comprehensive benefit set to include periodontal coverage, it is putting their health at risk and their treating provider in an ethical dilemma. We thank you for recognizing that there are actually two diseases of the mouth and for covering this in your bill. The second issue we want to talk about and comment on is the governor's One Care proposal. Our three critical access providers support streamlining the administrative process for our Medicaid dental system. There is a lack of transparency. Providers are paid wildly different rates and are denied their own fee schedules. Often rate increases are not fully passed through and cannot be required to do so because of federal rules. We believe having one single administrator contracted with the state would benefit providers and bring much needed transparency to this program. However, there is one issue that we struggle with, and that is that the One Care proposal completely eliminates the critical access dental program and all of the other dental add-ons in order to increase our very low base rate here in Minnesota. This is all done in the hopes that this will incentivize private dentists to increase treating folks in the Medicaid program. While we would hope that our waiting lists, which are at the thousands at every single clinic, would dwindle, we don't believe eliminating the critical access program and cutting the reimbursement rates for these providers is the way to go. We do want to say that we don't think we can wait to try and fix this. We've been working on this issue with you, Madam Chair, for many years and others around this table, and we look forward to having very productive conversations with you in the weeks ahead. Thank you for your commitment to oral health care.
Thank you for your testimony. Who's next? Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a psychologist, and I represent the Minnesota Psychological Association. I want to touch on two points. The first one is I want to ask you to consider credible alternatives to the repeal of the sunset of the provider tax. The provider tax is very burdensome to providers, and there are other workable alternatives that have been proposed, such as the claims expenditure assessment put forth by the Minnesota Medical Association, and we would just ask that you look at that and look at Representative Morrison's bill, because it would be less burdensome to providers while still funding safety net programs. The second thing, I'm going to jump back to Article 6 and just ask you to again consider rates for mental health services under medical assistance. Anything that you can do would help. I have providers calling me, especially after the Blue Cross debacle in January, calling and being on the verge of closing big clinics, and rates are just a very serious issue. If we could get a floor for the PMAPs or annual inflator, those kinds of things would be very helpful for us in terms of rates. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. That was not the bell, by the way. That was someone else's phone. Dr. Stark, did you want to finish? I don't know if you were done. Okay, that wasn't our bell. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Oldfield, and I'm the director of the local public health association. I'd first like to touch briefly on a provision in the spreadsheet before I go into Article 8. Local public health is on the front lines every day performing core state-mandated services to protect and promote the health of our communities, but past funding cuts and emerging threats, including infectious disease outbreaks, youth e-cigarette use, a growing mental health crisis, have pushed our system to a breaking point, and local tax levies are carrying the burden. We appreciate the increased investment in the local public health grant shown in the spreadsheet. This funding will begin to help community health boards restore local capacity to meet state mandates, address local priorities, and relieve tax levies. We hope you will continue to partner with us to explore additional investment opportunities for local public health. I'd also like to thank you for continued support of the Healthcare Access Fund in Article 8. Continued stability of the fund is a top priority for LPHA. The fund is crucial for access to healthcare, containing healthcare costs, and improving the quality of healthcare services for Minnesotans. The fund pays for more than addressing healthcare needs. It also invests in preventing chronic disease and reducing long-term healthcare costs through the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership, or SHIP. SHIP dollars go to our community health boards in all 87 counties and 10 tribal nations and support local efforts to reduce tobacco use and promote healthy eating and physical activity. We also appreciate the provision that allows for medical assistance coverage for asthma services. This will allow local public health departments to work with families to create healthy environments and reduce asthma triggers for young people. This will lead to reduced illness, less missed school, and lower health care costs. We know many difficult decisions were made when assembling this bill, and we appreciate your efforts to include funding and policy that will improve the health of Minnesota.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Sarah Anderson, and I represent the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Suppliers and Service Providers. We're here today to first thank you for not including language that was in the governor's proposal to drastically reduce all rates in the Medicaid program. We appreciate the exclusion of that provision. But we are concerned with some language and two omissions that were part of this proposal. First, by omitting language proposed under House File 473, which was repealing the Preferred Incontinence Program, we are at risk of the language that exists in statute today experiencing continuing litigation. This language was ruled unimplementable by Ramsey County District Judge Leonardo Castro last fall, and it inclusion of this language in pursuit of the PIP program will have dramatic impact on the quality and the access to necessary incontinence products for Minnesotans. Finally, we are concerned with the language included starting at line 537.1, addressing federal cures compliance. By reducing the rates to the Medicaid program to match the Medicare competitive bidding rates, we are risking access and quality to necessary types of durable medical equipment, including walkers, all types of wheelchairs, crutches, canes, CPAP devices, all things that are necessary to help Minnesotans with disabilities and other types of chronic conditions to maintain their ability to live in the community. The competitive bidding program that underpins CURES has failed federally. It resulted in the loss of nearly 50% of durable medical equipment companies across the country. The actions we took in Minnesota to prevent the impact of competitive bidding meant that our state did not see as dramatic of a reduction in access as the rest of the country, but with this language inclusion and matching the Medicare rate statewide, we fear that that may become our future. We ask you to consider the language proposed by House File 1580 in the future weeks that will help mitigate the risk to Minnesotans' access to this critical type of equipment. With that, we thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on Article 8? Welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen. I'm the Senior Manager of Advocacy with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Thank you for the inclusion of several provisions to address prescription drug costs and access issues which impact the everyday lives of Minnesotans living with multiple sclerosis. Two pieces in Article 10, which is regarding prescription drug price transparency. Representative Morrison's bill and Representative Cantrell's bill on formulary changes. Thank you for those inclusions. Specifically in this article, though, we wanted to thank you for the inclusion of Representative Akam's bill to extend step therapy override process to public programs. This language will make modifications to the way in which DHS will apply step therapy requirements in their prior authorization processes. By requiring DHS to include an override process, providers will have a greater say in the care of their patients and the medications they prescribe. Medical professionals should be the ones making these decisions for their patients, not DHS. Although this language is a positive step forward, we do continue to have concerns about the prior authorization process DHS will be implementing this summer across all public programs under their new formulary. Starting July 1st, DHS will be changing drug coverage for all enrollees in public programs. Instead of receiving drug coverage from an individual MCO, all enrollees will now be under DHS's preferred drug list. Although this approach provides consistency when an enrollee moves between MCOs, we're worried that many enrollees will be required to go through a lengthy prior authorization measure to maintain access to their current medications, and unless approved, be forced onto another drug or lose coverage entirely. Details on this transition have been lacking, and enrollees and providers have not been notified that their drug benefits will be changing in less than 3 months. In fact, the final version of the preferred drug list has not yet been posted publicly, even though it's been approved by DHS's Drug Formulary Committee and is open comment period. For those with complex medical conditions, maintaining access to a medication that keeps them stable and is crucial, and if they will be forced to find a new medication in July, they need to know right now. In the coming days, I encourage the committee to look at this unexpected emergency issue and try to find a way to ensure access to needed medications for this vulnerable population is maintained during this unexpected formulary change. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Article 8. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Eric Dick here on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association. If you'll forgive me, Madam Chair, I might speak to two articles, though I believe that they're related. We're grateful at the MMA for this committee's great work on prescription drug pricing and access. Representative Moran's committee, as well as Representative Halverson's committee, has done much good work on this. Specifically, we're strongly supportive and grateful for the inclusion of Representative Cantrell's bill to limit changes to formularies found in Article 10, Section 4. Representative Akam's bill to expand the step therapy override financing at DHS, Representative Morrison's bill to require drug price disclosure, and finally, Representative Mann's PBM licensure and transparency bill. There's increasing evidence that PBMs are, in many cases, putting more expensive drugs on formularies in the hopes of reaping higher profits. That doesn't serve consumers, nor does it serve the state as a payer. If I may, Madam Chair, just briefly shift to the provider tax and the Healthcare Access Fund. The MMA strongly agrees that we need to ensure coverage for low-income Minnesotans and other access programs funded by the Healthcare Access Fund. We would ask, however, that the legislature think creatively and consider an updated, modernized finance mechanism other than the provider tax. The MMA believes that there's a way forward that preserves coverage for low-income Minnesotans, eases the cost and burden of tax compliance for healthcare providers, and provides a stable, ongoing revenue source. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke with the Minnesota Hospital Association. There is a lot to like in this bill, and just a few highlights from the Minnesota Hospital Association's perspective. Number one, we're very supportive of the funding for the school-linked mental health program. Number two, we're very excited about expanding the certified community behavioral health clinics. Currently, there are six of those operating in our state, and this legislation would authorize funding up to 11. And also compliance with the new federal outpatient drug rule that is kind of a must that we have to do, otherwise it's a $190 million penalty for the state. There's a small increase of $1.5 million for hospitals with high DSH, disproportionate share hospitals, high Medicaid populations, and we're very grateful for that. But to move forward with many of the new initiatives in this bill, as well as keeping our ability to preserve coverage for low-income Minnesotans, MHA supports one of the key provisions of this legislation, and that is the repeal of the sunset on the provider tax. This represents the provider tax for the last 18 months of the biennium, because it is in place for the first 6 months of the biennium. It is $970 million. When that money is used in our medical assistance program, it leverages a federal matching dollar. So I want members to please understand that last biennium it was about $800 million, which represented about $1.6 billion for the biennium, and that's just, it's a lot of money that supports our ongoing health care needs here in Minnesota. If I may, Madam Chair, I'd just like to move forward to Article 9 for a quick minute. We at the Hospital Association are continuing to evaluate the platinum product offering under the OneCare proposal. But there is language on page 564, subdivision 9, that gives the commissioner the authority to modify the covered benefit set as well as the payments to providers. And it is unilateral authority for the commissioner to modify the benefit set and the payments. And at the Hospital Association, we would just be more comfortable if ultimately you move forward with the OneCare proposal, that this be a legislative decision and not an administration decision. So thank you for consideration of our comments.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Other testifiers on Article 8. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rod Franks here representing MACSA. It was just a few weeks ago that I sat in front of this committee testifying how eliminating the Health Care Access Fund would be a significant disruption to the lives of many Minnesotans that we work with through counties, and how eliminating this fund could lead to a cost counties just simply are ill suited to absorb. Therefore, we certainly appreciate the committee's support of maintaining the stability of the Healthcare Access Fund. This will allow counties to continue to ensure the immediate healthcare needs of the residents in need that we serve, as well as the upstream investments that it affords through the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership, or SHIP, program. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And he's a model for everybody. You can come back and talk on different articles. It's just fine. It's perfect. Anyone else on health care? Article 8. All right. Not seeing anyone. So we will move along then and go to Article 9, which is the OneCare article. And I know some of you have already touched on that. That's fine. You don't need to come back to speak on it again. But if anyone here just wants to speak on the OneCare article, please come on up. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Arianna Riles, Assistant Director of Children's Dental Services. I first want to thank Representative Liebling for her extensive work on dental rates and improving access to care for vulnerable Minnesotans. Children's Dental Services is a major safety net provider serving over 37,000 low-income children, pregnant women, and families annually in over 48 counties across Minnesota, nearly 70% of which are dental professional shortage areas. We operate a hub-and-spoke model in which we provide dental care directly on-site in settings where low-income families naturally congregate, including schools, Head Start centers, women, infant, and children clinics, and other community-based locations. This model of care is recognized as a state and national best practice for eliminating barriers in access to care and cannot be replaced by dental services provided in a traditional dental office. Children's Dental Services is only able to provide critically needed dental care because of programs such as the Critical Access Dental Provider Program and the Rural and Children's Reimbursement Rate add-ons. Even with these current add-ons, medical assistant payments only comprise 60% of Children's Dental Services' total budget, and 40% must still be raised by grants and philanthropic donations in order to make ends meet. I therefore urge this committee to ensure that any replacement of these add-on payments does not decrease the reimbursements received by Children's Dental Services or any other safety net provider, as doing so will result in significant decreases in access to care for our most vulnerable Minnesotans. Thank you again for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else who wanted to comment on the One Care provision, Article 9? Okay, not seeing anybody, so we'll move along to the prescription drug article, Article 10. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Gerard Associates, representing the Association for Accessible Medicines. There are a number of provisions in this article, other articles, and actually in other bills that are moving that impact prescription drugs. And I would just like to encourage the committee and the legislature to look at how the various provisions interact with one another. As you've heard me say before, generic drugs are 90% of the market and 23% of the cost. And I think it's in all of our best interest to make sure that what we're doing in the legislature with respect to prescription drugs maintains the cost-saving benefits of generics and biosimilars. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And anyone else who wanted to talk about the prescription drug article in the bill? Okay. 11, health licensing boards. Okay. No one stepping forward on that one, health licensing boards. Article 12, health department. A little bit misnamed. We could probably call this the public health article. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Oldfield. On behalf of the local Public Health Association, I would like to thank you for including several tobacco prevention policies in Article 12, including creating state-based tobacco cessation services. Without this policy and funding, Minnesota would become the only state without a cessation quit line. Further, we support the provisions that will take tobacco litigation proceeds and dedicate them to tobacco prevention. And we also appreciate you including that increasing the tobacco age to 21. Tobacco prevention and cessation pays off with improved health outcomes and lower health care costs. We also hope the bill will be amended to include the policy that adds e-cigarettes to the Clean Indoor Air Law. Further, we'd like to thank you for the inclusion of policies that prevent opioid misuse. The opioid epidemic is a complex health problem that requires a collaborative response. To change current trends, we must work across the full continuum of care, from public health prevention to treatment. Local public health is a key partner in working upstream on youth prevention, provider education, public education, and safe disposal of prescription drugs. Last but not least, we'd like to thank you, the committee, for its support of family home visiting provisions in Article 12. These crucial programs improve health outcomes for our youngest residents. Thank you for your work to protect the health of Minnesotans.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Renal Ray. I'm the Associate Executive Director at People Serving People. I'm also the co-chair of the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition. I'm here today to testify on Article 12, Section 49, the Community Solutions for Healthy Child Development Grant Program. On behalf of our coalition, we want to thank you for including this grant program in the omnibus bill. We're also thankful for Representative Kunesh Pudin and our bill authors for seeing this bill to this point. And we're also thankful to the governor, lieutenant governor, and the department for their support of this program and this opportunity. Investment directly in community-led solutions is an excellent and innovative way to address early childhood health equity. As a coalition, we're committed to prioritizing equity and ask the chair and members to keep it as a priority throughout the rest of this session. And also, with the majority of children who on Article 1, excuse me, with the majority of children who utilize CCAP as being children of color, we also appreciate and thank you for the increased investment in CCAP in this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Other testimony. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Tuburin, he and his public policy director with Justice Health, and I'd like to speak in support of provisions regarding HIV and AIDS care and prevention in this bill. At the beginning of this session, this committee heard a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Health on a plan to end AIDS that the previous legislature required them to develop, and we are very excited that this bill provides critical steps forward in achieving that mission. There are three provisions in this bill to improve HIV prevention, improve care, and the reduction of stigma. It is important for you to know that this bill includes the boldest advances in two decades to combat the HIV epidemic, and we thank you for your commitment to ending AIDS. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Eric Dick again with the Minnesota Medical Association. Thank you for the opportunity to return to the table. One of the guiding principles of the Minnesota Medical Association is that Minnesota be the healthiest state in the nation. And we are very grateful for the inclusion of two very important provisions that will go a long way in accomplishing that goal. We're grateful for the inclusion of Representative Edelson's Tobacco 21 legislation found in Article 12, Sections 77 through 86, and related provision, Representative Mann's cessation funding services. We're very grateful for the inclusion of these two provisions. I would make one humble request that the committee consider Representative Freiberg's House File 1182. This is his bill to fund education and outreach efforts in communities with lower rates of immunizations. In the summer of 2017, Minnesota was the scene of a measles outbreak that sickened almost 80, two-thirds of which were hospitalized. These are very dangerous diseases, and candidly, they're also very expensive diseases. And Minnesota, unfortunately, has seen pockets of lower rates of immunization. We think Representative Freiberg's bill, House File 1182, is an important step forward. Thanks for your time, members.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I am representing Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, or MCCL. First, I'd like to thank the committee for a number of provisions in the bill that do provide support and help to pregnant women and babies as well. But I would like to focus my comments on the Positive Alternatives Grant Program. The DeLito recommends a 25% cut as well as policy changes to this program. Positive Alternatives was created with the goal of leveraging community organizations to ensure that no woman is ever forced into having an unwanted abortion because of a lack of support and resources. In order to achieve this, funded programs must agree to support, encourage, and assist women in carrying their pregnancies to term and care for their babies after birth, including providing or referring for 7 necessary services ranging from nutrition to employment. Today, more than 7,000 families are helped through Positive Alternatives each year at an average cost of less than $500 per family. If this cut goes through, roughly 1,700 families will lose out and may abort their wanted child because of a lack of support and not being aware of the resources available to them. In 2005, Minnesota saw an average of 14,000 abortions per year. Today, that number is between 9 and 10,000. This proven program really does make a difference. Most of you weren't here back in 2005, but a diverse group of organizations worked on this legislation, specifically the sections dealing with medically accurate information and privacy protections. In the end, 112 House members and 53 senators supported the final bill, including our chair. I would like to close with the words of Planned Parenthood's lobbyist at the time, Connie Perpich. Planned Parenthood of Minnesota has worked hard with all members of the Minnesota Senate to find language that we feel will ensure that this new program will have a bipartisan foundation and be supported by pro-life and pro-choice members sincerely interested in improving programs designed to assist pregnant women in need. The Senate action on the MCCL's Positive Alternatives Bill indicates that common ground can be found when all sides are asked to work on a common goal. We hope that the legislature will explore additional venues in the future for honest dialogue in this area. I couldn't agree with Ms. Perpich more. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Others who would want to speak on Article 12? We're still on Article 12, public health article. No? Okay, I think we're done with Article 12, and we're on to Article 13, and that is health coverage. So Article 13, health coverage. Okay, not seeing any testimony on that. Article 14, we're into the resident rights and consumer protections portion of the bill. This is getting into the new elders section. Okay, not seeing anyone on that. Article 15, independent senior living facilities. Article 16, assisted living licensure. Article 17, dementia care services for assisted living facilities with dementia care. And Article 18, assisted living licensure conforming changes. Okay, and the final article is Article 19, miscellaneous. And since it's miscellaneous, I know some of you might have perhaps missed the opportunity when it came up earlier in the day. And so, you know, if we missed you or you missed us as we were zooming through, why come on up. And then what about 20? Okay. And then Mr. McQuillan reminds me, too, that we will also have Article 21, which is appropriations. So I kind of think people have discussed that as we went through, but let's do the miscellaneous, and we'll also have an opportunity if anyone wants to just talk about the appropriations article. So welcome to the committee. And this one, you'll really need to let us know what you're going to be addressing.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Allison Strake, and I'm the Deputy Director of Carver County CDA and co-chair of the Home Sprawl Coalition. On behalf of all of us at Homes for All, we appreciate your understanding that investments in critical housing stabilization programs, including the Homeless Youth Act, Emergency Services Program, and long-term homeless supportive services are life-changing for those experiencing housing instability and homelessness. These investments are especially critical right now as the region faces the highest number of people experiencing homelessness since 2012, according to a recent report from Wilder Research. The Wilder study also found that the number of people experiencing homelessness who are not in a formal shelter, outside or doubled up, increased 62% since 2015. Minnesota Housing and its work on unsheltered homelessness has found that unsheltered homelessness has increased 24.7% on average per year for the past 3 years in the Twin Cities metro. This is more than five times the national rate, so it greatly exceeds national trends. Increased public investment in housing stabilization tools, including emergency services program, the long-term homeless supportive services, and the Homeless Youth Act,
Working together with shelter and housing options will better meet the needs of our unsheltered homeless and will sustain vital community partners. However, as the 2018 Wilder study finds, 10,233 people experiencing homelessness, a 10% increase since 2015. The investments simply do not reflect the needs across the state. It is therefore critical that these investments are funded at an increased level to address that need. Without stronger investments in housing stabilization programs, we will simply be unable to address the needs of so many Minnesotans, including those with the least options and fewest resources, and make progress towards addressing racial disparities. We hope to also see increased investments in other critical housing tools, including housing supports and supportive housing for adults with serious mental illness. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, respected committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Michelle Basham. I'm the executive director of the Bridge for Youth and the co-chair of YSN, which is a statewide collaborative of organizations advocating for homeless youth. On behalf of YSN, I wish to extend our sincere gratitude and thanks to all of you for the inclusion of the Homeless Youth Act increase rider in the omnibus bill. As the testifier before me said, each night in Minnesota, more than 6,000 youth are homeless. And not only as the executive director of the Bridge and the co-chair of YSN, as a person with lived experience, I can tell you, moving out at 15 and being declared independent at 16 with very few options is not a nice place to be. I'm going to tell you more today briefly about Andre. His mother raised him and his siblings on her own with very little resources. She did her best, but as time went on, her mental health challenges got worse, and she became more and more abusive to Andre, until at 14 years old, she told him he needed to make his own way in the world. And so he left, and so he tried. He was beaten, he was raped, he was victimized multiple times before finding a homeless youth agency. Thankfully, he was able to live there, graduate from high school, and today he has a job and is an advocate for homeless youth. He couldn't get there without these programs and the Homeless Youth Act. But besides shelter and housing and the Homeless Youth Act, I want to also respectfully ask you to please include language concerning vital documents. Due to homelessness as well as removals from home by child protection, too many of our kids do not have access to critical vital documents. Without those, they can't get a job, they can't get housing, and ultimately, most importantly, they cannot move out of homelessness. So I would ask you respectfully to include language from DHS regarding vital documents. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Hello, thank you. I'm Erica Barnes, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the formation of the Rare Disease Advisory Council. I think it's Section 9. And I just wanted to thank everyone who's worked on this, and I wanted to come and thank the committee on behalf of the coalition. When I started this journey about a year and a half ago, it was literally me and a professor at the University of Minnesota sitting in our office and in his office, and I said, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we could find people who would support a Rare Disease Advisory Council in the state of Minnesota? And now the coalition has grown to about 40 strong. The coalition is made up of a diverse set of stakeholders, from patient advocacy groups to the medical community, medical associations, and industry, representing all the stakeholders in the rare disease space. So I just want to thank you all so much for your work. Thank you, Representative Mann, for all the hard work she's been doing as the chief author. And then I also just wanted to talk a little bit about the duties that are included. Currently, rare patients are expected to often be their own rare disease experts, their own medical fundraisers, and their own care navigators. My daughter was treated at the Mayo Clinic, and I'll never forget when one of the Mayo doctors walked into my room and asked me to remind him what kind of cancer my daughter had. And I said, actually, my daughter does not have cancer.
and I had to spend a fair amount of time educating him on the disease that my daughter had. It was the first time the Mayo Clinic had ever treated metachromatic leukodystrophy. I was very happy with the collaboration. Right in her medical notes, they had said, if you have any questions, ask the parents. They have a lot of expertise on the disease. And I love that collaboration. It's an amazing thing, but I also know that there are lots of parents who would not have had the capacity to have that kind of education and be able to do that kind of educating of the medical community. So this council will finally take some of that pressure off of the rare patients and put it onto a group of individuals who can help us in Minnesota move the dial forward in terms of rare disease research acceleration and medical advancement. I also want to thank you so much for funding the council. Being able to cover their operational costs will give the volunteer council members the opportunity to really focus on some very meaningful solutions to the barriers and problems in the rare disease community, and be able to make advances and be able to finally help the rare disease community be truly included in our healthcare system. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Other testifiers on the miscellaneous, or come on down. If we missed you or you missed us, it's fine. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nancy Hilden. And this is missed from Article 1.
Okay.
Section 45. This is a Chair Dabney bill on support for First Children's Finance, a revolving loan program. And I was pleasantly surprised when we went to meet with Representative Schumacher. I thought we'd have to step way back and explain who First Children's Finance was. And when we went in, he immediately said, I know First Children's Finance. They came down to Laverne and helped us do some training for our providers. And he is a co-author. So we have strong bipartisan, and a number of you are also on this bill. First Children's Finance is grateful that this bill includes funding that will provide an incredible opportunity to make real progress with our child care providers in the state, center and home-based, urban and rural. Since 1991, almost 30 years ago, First Children's Finance has been an ally with the State Department of Human Services and numerous philanthropic partners to support the business of child care. First Children's Finance does this with the trained staff that they have on the ground in every corner of the state. First of all, they do that with proprietary analytics that help providers maximize their capacity and earning potential while improving quality for the children they serve. And secondly, and very importantly, with financial resources available to those providers. The revolving loan fund that is created in this bill will allow First Children's Finance to increase the number of providers that they can support with a combination of low interest and forgivable loans and outright grants. First Children's Finance will identify the best path for each provider in the community they serve to ensure their success in the long run. They will put every penny to good use and reuse. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. The other people that want to testify either on Article 19 miscellaneous or something that we missed or you missed? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone. How about Article 21, which is the appropriations article, if there's something that you didn't tell us in the course of your other testimony? Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rod Franks, representing counties in MACSA. Well, changing the way we deliver human services is really an incredible challenge. However, as counties, we know that we must continue our evolution to a more person-centered model that serves the whole person, whole family, to be most effective. To accomplish this goal, we must update our woefully outdated technology systems. Some of these systems that we use are still DOS-based green screen systems, written in code that I studied as an undergraduate at the University of Minnesota. I won't tell you how long ago that was. We appreciate the $10 million appropriation that this bill includes to help us on this road. However, we would encourage the committee to consider the governor's proposal for $20 million so that we can truly invest in this transformational work. Part of this transformation discussion really includes the federal legislation, the Family First Prevention and Services Act, or Families First. Counties see the Family First as an opportunity to make monumental changes in our child welfare practices. As an association, MACSA has committed to work with the state and stakeholders to leverage the Families First Preservation Act, not just as a way to keep the lights on in our system, but really as a means to light the way to transform our child welfare system here in Minnesota. This will allow us to more effectively support the children and families that we serve. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Franks. Okay. Is there anybody else in the room who feels they want to be heard on something in this bill? Okay. Are you sure now? We got time. Okay. All right. Well, that being the case, thank you to everyone who testified. And I don't know if you could tell, but I was taking notes of everything that everyone said. And I know other members were listening intently. And, you know, I appreciate both your appreciation of the bill and also the things that you told us are missing or are not right. And, you know, if the bill is going to go through the amendment process, we will, if there are things that we can remedy, I think many of us are interested in doing that. And, of course, I think everyone will, I know many of the folks who testified understand that one bill can't do everything and that we do have limited resources and every omnibus bill has to make really difficult choices. And we've tried to do this as best we can with recognition that we've left some things undone that are also very important. So with that, we just would like to just kind of tell you what the next step is here. So tomorrow, this committee will not meet.
What?
I know, Representative Franson. We will miss seeing you tomorrow. So we will, the deadline for amendments is noon. So if someone in the room wants to be sure that you get an amendment, talk to a member and make sure that, you know, you've talked to someone about that and that we can get it done early enough because House Research is going to be frantically drafting all of these amendments to get them done in time. So this committee will meet starting at 8 o'clock on Friday morning. The intention then is to go from 8 o'clock till 11 a.m. and break because we have floor session on Friday. And then our intention is to come back on Friday evening and continue marking up the bill. And, of course, we'll have to see how late the session goes. And then, if necessary, we'll be back at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, I'm sorry to say. But we've got to get our work done, and by the end of Saturday, we should have this bill in its form to move out to Ways and Means. So we will. So Friday, we're going to meet here in room 200. So Friday at 8 o'clock. Are there any questions from members or concerns about the schedule? All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone. We are adjourned.